This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
Oh, hello, everybody. So nice to have you here on Monday morning. It's April. It's gorgeous. No, it's May. Holy crap, it's May. Can you believe it? May 1st. This year has flown by. Hey, welcome to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. As always, I'm your host, Shane Told. And things are really good with me. Thanks for asking. Yeah, man. I got so much stuff going on right now. It is wild. It is crazy. Silverstein just got back from a tour with Good Charlotte, which was super fun. Different kind of tour for us. You know, we're not really a pop punk band, but the Madden Brothers were cool. All the other members of Good Charlotte are super, super nice guys. So that was a lot of fun. Thanks to everybody who came out across Canada to hang with me. It was very nice to see some sinners all up in there. And coming up next, I'm doing a solo tour. River Oaks, that's the name of my solo project. I'll be playing some of those songs, a bunch of Silverstein songs, acoustic covers, all kinds of stuff. It will be very fun. Yeah, that's happening soon. Like, the first show is May 10th, so we're going to be like 10 days out from now. So make sure you grab tickets if you live in the following cities, because this is where I'm coming. I'm coming to Chicago, Las Vegas, woohoo, Los Angeles, Anaheim, and San Diego. All great places. I know people are going to be coming out in droves, so get your tickets now. RiverOaksMusic.com. They're like $13 or something. They're super cheap, and there is a VIP option too if you want to say hi, whatever. I mean, you can say hi to me anyways, but if you want to make it a formal thing, we got the VIP option again. That's RiverOaksMusic.com. After that, Silverstein's heading to South America, and then the entire Warped Tour. Oh, my God. And that is a nice segue into today's episode. We have Kay Flay on the show, a little bit different guest for this show, although apparently she is getting to be quite the metalhead. I ask her about that. And we talk a lot about Warped Tour because she did Warped Tour back in 2014. And yeah, well, I don't want to spoil it. She'll be talking about it. It's so great to have her. She is awesome. If you don't know about her yet, you will. And her music is super unique. It's catchy, but it's also important. And I think it's important to have women on the show. And of course, it's important to have people from all different genres. I don't want to just stick to punk rock or metal or metalcore or emo or whatever. I know that's my scene. That's the music I play. So that tends to be what happens on the show. But this is Lead Singer Syndrome. It doesn't matter what the genre is. If you're a lead singer, you can be on the show. Before we get into it with Kay Flay, again, I love the feedback. I love when people get in touch. Email leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. We're on all the social media. I know I rhyme them off every week. I won't do that this week. And if you like the show, feel free to write a review on iTunes, preferably 5 stars. It does go a long way in shooting this thing up the charts, you know, which apparently my producers say is important. So I don't know. If you like the show, that would really help us out. Another way you can help us out is if you buy anything on Amazon, use the Amazon affiliate link. The link for that is just leadsingersyndrome.com/Amazon. Takes you right to the Amazon homepage. You log in like normal. And anything you buy, we get 4-6%. It costs you absolutely nothing. I don't know why they do it, but I don't care. It really does help keep the lights on. Speaking of keeping the lights on, we do have the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. I'm not going to talk about it at all this week. If you need more content, if once a week is not enough for you, we have this option. We have a great group. Shout out to all my sinners. Love you all. Check it out. The link for that is leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. Another thing I've been doing for the past few weeks is talking about all the other great podcasts that are on the Jabberjaw Podcast Network. This week, I'm going to talk about one that I've been on before, run by my very, very good friend, Ray Harkins. It's called 100 Words or Less. It's a show I've been listening to myself for years. I don't even know what episode Ray is up to. many, many episodes, many great episodes. I think he's interviewed 4 out of 5 members of my band. And I got to be honest, his podcast is a big inspiration for what I do. Big, big time. So as for the description, 100 words or less is a discussion with people in and around independent music with host Ray Harkins. The show gets in deep with creators and people who've been profoundly influenced by independent music and DIY culture. Upcoming guests include Josh Scogan from 68 Norma Jean, that's a good guest, and Cameron from Sorority Noise, and 250 past episodes to dive into. There you go, 250 episodes. Visit 100wordspodcast.com or just search for 100 words or less on your favorite podcast app. All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it's time. Here is my conversation with Kay Flay.
Maybe I've been slipping back, heading south, car sick on a Tuesday, missing cash, blacking out, heartless in a few ways, shit for luck, elbow shredded, I held things steady like too late, please calm the fuck down, I'll do whatever you say. I get it, I'm living too hard and it's time that I stop it, but rising on up and then tumbling down, well that's part of the process, bar tabs on a hot night in a cold basement. Say I'm crazy, but I feel amazing. My mother told me that the world has got its plan.
Hey, what's up?
Not too much. How you doing?
Hey, I'm super good. You actually called on time. Like, no one ever calls on time.
I'm sorry. I'm actually a couple minutes late, in fact, because your phone number wasn't in my calendar, so I had to find it out. So I would have actually been incredibly... I was raised in this very like old-fashioned Midwest way where I like have to be on time for everything.
That's amazing because I'm never on time for anything ever. I'm the worst. So yeah, so no, that's impressive. So I'm very impressed because, you know, like sometimes like we set this up like, I don't know, a week ago, and I'm usually with people, I'm like, yeah, remember we have this thing tomorrow, and someone's like, yeah, and then they still forget. So, you know, it's just rock and roll. People are notoriously absent-minded, and you're not.
Yeah, I'm printed.
But I heard you're a metalhead now, super big into metal.
Well, I'm getting there. I mean, I would definitely not call myself a metalhead quite yet. But, you know, for me, the sort of kind of musical exploration of the last couple of years has been heavy music. Like,
cool.
Growing up, I was scared of it.
Oh, really?
Kind of. Well... I think I had this sense that heavy music gave me anxiety.
Interesting.
And that can still be true. I'm not going to say that, like, blanket statement, that's not the case. But, you know, I think once I got exposed to it and started really digging in, I realized that it did not make me anxious.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, with me, I don't know. When I first heard, you know, my first love was, I don't want to talk about you, but my first love was metal. And I remember my older sister, 7 years older than me, used to blare like Metallica in her room, you know, and I wasn't allowed to go in there. So it was like the coolest thing. And then right away when, you know, when she would be out with her friends, I'd like sneak into her room and like play those records. And for me, it was the opposite of anxiety. Like I felt a release or something. And I don't know why, because I'm like 10, 11 years old. Like, I don't know what I was angry about, but I felt this like release from, you know, and it was absolutely for me, it was almost relaxing. So.
Totally. And I think I'm like getting there. And I have to say, I'm listening to like heavy music and it kind of some experimental stuff, some metal too, but yeah. I'm not like fully metallic yet.
Right. Yeah, well, it's a slippery slope. I mean, you're going to be listening to like, I don't know, like Cradle of Filth or something before you know it.
Oh, God. I don't know. See, band names like that scare me still. Like, I'm like, oh, God. I mean, no offense to them. I'm sure they're, like, very nice people.
I'm sure they're lovely.
That's yeah.
Really funny.
That's just such a gnarly name.
Yes, it definitely is. But back to you. I mean, it's really, really nice to have you, and thanks for taking the time to do this. You know, we talk about metal right away, which is funny, because I do interview a lot of metal guys, punk guys and stuff. And you're... So, kind of all over the place, and I don't mean that in an insulting way, just musically, and I find it really interesting just kind of the way you came up, and it's very atypical how you know, your music career path has gone. So I guess, like, the place to start that makes the most sense is just kind of from the beginning. I mean, you know, we got long format and stuff, so there's always lots to talk about. And, you know, you say you grew up in the Midwest. What was your exposure like to music, like, early in your life?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. As you say, my entry into music and kind of my path has been sort of atypical. And I think I realized this recently. I think a lot of that stems from the fact that music wasn't a part of my emotional or social identity as a young person. Like, I talk to a lot of, you know, musicians now, and they're like, even like you're saying, like, blasting music in your room and feeling this kind of, like, you know, psychic or emotional release. I didn't have that experience until my 20s. So it, you know, there was music in the household for sure. And my parents, I have a biological dad, a stepdad who then adopted me, and my mom. And so all three of them were, you know, listen to music and go to concerts, still go to a ton of concerts.
Yeah.
And are certainly, you know, invested, I think, in music and in live music especially. But for whatever reason, it never, you know, I listened to music, I go to concerts, but it was never like this part of me in a visceral way. And right. I think as a consequence of that, I've just had a very strange journey through everything.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Yeah, like, it sounds like almost as a, you know, teenager, whatever, into, you know, into becoming an adult, you just didn't have passion for music, which is kind of crazy. Yeah. I think I read somewhere that your father was like a guitar player or something too.
Yeah. So my dad played guitar. My dad and my uncle actually would play together. My uncle and my cousin are actually quite good guitarists, but yeah, my dad taught me to play guitar, really basic stuff, when I was like maybe 11 or something. And so I had knowledge of that, and I enjoyed it. But again, it wasn't that wiring in my brain kind of hadn't solidified yet. And I think, you know, I was like a really serious student and a very, like, I was like a really serious basketball player. And
oh, cool.
All this. Yeah, like, I think I had these other super regimented ways of dealing with my own mind. And then I found music, and it was like this chaotic maelstrom swirling, you know, whatever, that was very appealing to me once I found it.
I guess you were a Bulls fan, maybe?
I am a Bulls fan.
Yeah, well, from Illinois, and think about how great the Bulls were back, you know, in the 90s.
I know. I did come of age in, like, the golden era of the Bulls, which is pretty nice.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was a Bulls fan, too, and I'm from Toronto. So, But you say that about having these kind of other passions and music sort of fading away and passions changing. And sometimes I talk to guys, and we'll talk on this thing, and we'll just start talking about sports. And, you know, it's a music podcast. Half the people listening to this, or more than half the people, don't give a fuck about sports at all. And then it's funny because people will always say, like, oh, I was a kid and I was kind of into sports, and then I got so immersed in music and now I'm, like, really into sports again. And it's funny how these, like, passions come and go. And in a way, maybe that's, like, what's happening with you in music. Like, you kind of abandoned music a little bit, you know, in your teens, and then was like, holy shit, wait a second. Music's actually, like, important to me. You know,
yeah,
except you were a late bloomer. But was there, like, anyone saying to you, like, when you were, whatever, you say, like, 20, you know, already in, like, college, was there anybody saying to you, like, oh, it's too late, like, sorry, it's over for you? Like,
no, you know, it's funny, nobody ever said that to me, and the thought never crossed my mind. I mean, the other thing to remember too is, like, when I started making music, I had no aspirations of doing it, like, as a job,
right,
or in any professional capacity. So, I think I've always been sort of marching to my own rhythm my whole life. And not to say I'm oblivious to the world, because I'm not, like, I'm aware of what's going on, but I sort of developed this disregard for, like, other people's expectations of me when I was pretty young. And I think, you know, as a consequence, once I've put my mind onto something, I approach it with, like, this childlike zeal, and maybe it's a little bit naive too, but it's very pure. And I think that's kind of driven, I mean, even even to this day, like me learning new instruments, like I'm like a little kid. I'm like smiling. I'm so happy. So it's just, yeah, there was something very pure, I think, about the way I approached it. And maybe as a consequence of that, nobody ever questioned it.
Right. Yeah. I guess there's a certain level of just kind of confidence and fun that goes into it. But, you know, I always say, like, it's better to be a little naive than be jaded. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I still feel like there's times when I'm, no matter how long I've been doing this, I've been singing for my band for like 17 years, and I still want to have that excitement. I still want to smile, you know, and I don't want to feel like I know everything and I hate everything. And I think that's like, if you can keep that for as long as possible, like that's really something you can hang on to.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me also, because this isn't like a quote unquote childhood dream of mine. I mean, it's my current dream and passion and life pursuit, but there's a level of disbelief that accompanies everything I do where I'm like, this is fucking weird. Like, I had never been on stage. I had never, you know, so every experience that I have, I'm kind of like, I'm like half anthropologist, half kid. You know, I'm just like, this is kind of a weird thing. Like, even, you know, when I played Warped Tour, like, I don't know, in 2014, and I really felt like I was on Mars. It was the craziest thing. And my friend Nick, who was playing drums with me at the time, he grew up going to Warped Tour, so he was like stoked. He knew everything. Like, you know, he was in his element, and I felt like, you know, I was like exploring and discovering this world. And that's kind of how I always feel. I'm like, this is strange that I'm doing this, but I like it, but it's also strange.
Yeah. Well, the way you seem to approach things is, I don't want to say strange, but it's not, like I said, atypical. And I think that that makes you, you, and I think that that makes you special and makes you interesting. And, you know, it's funny, Warped Tour is a, you know, my band's done Warped Tour. We're doing it this summer. It's going to be our eighth time.
Oh, my God. So you know. Yeah.
Oh, I know. And I've been going, I've been to every single one since 1997 was the first one I went to as a, like a fan. And then I've gone or played every year since. So, yeah, for me, I'm like your drummer.
Right.
You know, but I can totally understand how weird that would be. I mean, especially, I guess, not earlier in your career, but, like, you hadn't done a ton of festival tours, probably. You know, you hadn't really toured with all these different kinds of bands. And then Warped Tour just has the weirdest stuff where, like, you don't know what time you're going to play. Like, that's that whole thing, you know. So would you do it again?
No. You know what's funny is I... From a social perspective and kind of like the people that I've been drawn to throughout my career, there are so many people who've played Warped Tour, been involved with it, are in that scene that I've just naturally gravitated towards. And because I think there is, regardless of genre, so much of my like personal ethos is like just like to be humble. Not like, I'm not trying to be like one of these people out there, like be humble. But you know, like I think it's important to have a high level of humility. I also think it's important to, you know, like retain a DIY kind of perspective on your life, not just your career. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of commonalities. So from a social perspective, I really enjoyed it, but from a lifestyle perspective, I think like I felt like I almost died. Like it was.
Did you do the whole thing?
I did the whole thing. Yeah.
Oh damn. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I just reached this point where like I'd wake up at 7, you know, to check the schedule, see what I'm playing.
Yeah.
And like we had kind of had like my tour manager basically like had a nervous breakdown, had to leave. So there were. I was kind of out on my own towards the end, and I would wake up at like 7. There would be no water on the bus. I would, out of just thirst, drink a beer. I was like, this is so wrong.
Yeah, out of thirst, sure.
Yeah. Well, thirst and just like I get basic survival.
Yes, I get very thirsty on Warped Tour, if you know what I mean. out behind the trailer with like 24 Coors Lights or something.
Oh my God. Yeah. It was just from, and I'm really bad at being hot. Like I get really, really like psychologically disturbed when I'm hot for a long time. And so I think I was, yeah, it was too hot for me. Too
yep.
hot for me.
No, it's brutal. And yeah, we definitely. damn, so much to talk about. This is awesome. So yeah, I know. I mean, I know like obviously you kind of got started sort of more in like the rap world, I guess. I don't really know how to just like talk about that, but it seems like now you could go on tour with like a rock band, a rap group, something else, like indie rock. I don't even know really like where you're at with that. So talk me through a little bit how you got kind of like got started, some of your first tours and sort of what you found about like maybe about the rap world, and kind of now leading you into the rock world, and now I don't even know kind of where you're where you're standing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so yeah, the whole genesis of me starting to make music was that I was exposed to indie rap and like conscious rap and sort of like spoken word stuff like Saul Williams and, you know, all this really, for me, both from an intellectual perspective, like I'm listening to this and I'm thinking like, this is fucking smart. This is like social commentary that is framed in this really interesting way. And then on the flip side, from a wordplay and like word game perspective, I think I was really drawn to it because the one common theme throughout my whole life is that I love the power of language and the ability we all have to manipulate it. And I think it's kind of like the ultimate human magic trick is language. And, you know, out of thin air, we made this thing and now you and I are talking on, and granted we've made some magic cause I'm talking to you on FaceTime audio and I don't honestly know exactly what that is, but
it sounds great.
Sounds great. But without, you know, without this, like, I do think it's out of thin air. We've made this thing and it's a beautiful thing. So that was my entry point. And I just started rapping and I was in the Bay Area, and I just, you know, there were a lot of, there's kind of like a rap crew in on the West Coast called the Living Legends. And a bunch of those dudes were really big supporters of me early on. And that was just kind of, I think really at that time in my life was just so exciting to me. And it still is exciting to me. But again, speaking to like this childlike, you know, wonderment. Then I started discovering like live instruments and I had the ability to record in a studio. And, you know, as I became exposed to, I think, a broader spectrum of music making. And once I learned how to kind of sing, I didn't really know how to, I guess, sort of use my own voice in that way. Once I kind of got in touch with that, then it started to coalesce a bit. And this was all happening, by the way, like I was basically signed to RCA very early in my career.
Yes.
And so I was like doing a lot of studio sessions and playing a lot of opening on a lot of different tours. Like early on, I opened for Passion Pit and 303, Theophilus London. Like I was doing like rap stuff, indie stuff, whatever. And I think just it was all kind of like a soup in my head.
Yeah, well, I mean, coming from, you know, starting out so late and not really knowing that much about the music industry, was there some darkness you found and some, like, things you were like, ah, fuck, that kind of sucks, like, and this is going to be a thing now that's, like, a part of what I do? Like, was there some things that you kind of, like, you know, when you pull back the curtain and you look, were there some things like that just sort of bummed you out or maybe still do?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I will say that, so I met my manager, Seth, who's like also my best friend. We lived together in New York for many years. And then he and his now fiance and I all lived together like super, super tight. But, you know, we met right at the beginning. And I think if you're able to have a team around you that has the same values and the same level of both, or the same kind of like optimism, cynicism balance, I do think it sort of protects you. Like even when you are really disillusioned by something or disappointed, it's like a family, you know, even if you have a bad day at school, if your family rules, like it's kind of okay. Or if your really tight group of friends, you know, is great and supports you and shares your belief system. I think it's like a protection against some of that. But oh, I mean, undoubtedly I'm bummed out by things. You know, I think what kind of bums me out is there's this tendency right now to sign artists really early on. And, you know, as someone who went through that process, and luckily, you know, I think emerged for the better. I've just seen a lot of people with tremendous talent, but it's so undeveloped and so nascent, and their identity is, it's like a very nebulous thing. Them get kind of sucked into a machine that isn't made for them, and they don't come out very happy on the other side. So I think that's something that kind of, you know, it kind of disappoints me, just because I've sort of been there, and I know it takes a lot of resilience and a really, like I say, like that strong family to help you make it through.
No, definitely.
And plus, I will also say, I know you're a man, and I love many men, but there are a lot of really creepy men in the music industry.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to throw rap under the bus. You know, obviously rap is the most outwardly with some of the like lyrical content. You know what I mean? But I mean, rock music isn't great either. Music industry is not great either. For people being misogynistic and shitty. I mean, that must have been, was that hard for you to like kind of wrap your head around, or did you sort of expect it?
Well, I expected it. I mean, you know, our president right now is Donald Trump, who pretty much like hates women. So I don't find it shocking at all. I think our entire world is unfortunately filled with a lot of misogyny and other forms of kind of like weird deep-seated hatred. But so it wasn't surprising. And you know, I was raised in a very I was just, my whole family, my brother was raised, both my dads, like they are super, super feminist, mm-hmm. and you know, it raised me in that capacity. So I wasn't personally super affected by it. I think just to an internal, you know, I'm lucky to have that kind of candle burning within me, but, I mean, it's hard when you look at, you know, you take label meetings and everyone, all the high level executives are men. You don't see anyone who's, you know, like, it is weird. Like, I'm constantly with men. I'm just, like, all the time with men. And sometimes I say to, you know, the people I work with, I'm like, can you imagine, just, like, imagine the flip side for a sec. If you were in a room with 15 women, like, what would that feel like for you?
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's more just like it's kind of a trip. It's bizarre. Sorry, that was kind of a disorganized answer.
Oh, I like disorganized answers. I love the tangents. Don't get me wrong. Okay. I love it. That's the beauty of this.
I'm drinking coffee, a lot of it right now.
Like I'm jealous.
You know when you're drinking coffee like it's water? You're like, oh, I'm just going to take gigantic gulps of this.
That's and every day like, for what? Me. Yes. That's how I roll. You mentioned Trump. I know you have a song on the new record. The new record's fantastic, by the way. I really,
Thank
really
you.
Like it. And you have a song called President Has a Sex Tape, which is a pretty... Like, you're not trying to be very mysterious with the lyrics or what you're talking about. You're being very pointed. Talk me a little bit through that song, like, when it was written. Because, obviously, like, everyone kind of thought, oh, this might happen, you know, back at the end of last year. And then... But no one really thought it would. And then it did. And it was like, oh, fuck. Like, when did you write that song? And kind of talk me through exactly, like, if there's a specific thing about it or how it all came about.
Yeah. So that song. Okay. So I was at home for this Christmas with my family. And I have a brother and a sister. And we were all home, which is, like, kind of rare due to our weird jobs and, like, they both live on the East Coast. My parents are in the Bay Area, and I'm wherever the hell I am in the world. And so we were all together, which was great. But my parents just moved to like a small, like an apartment type space. So we were really crowded. Like we were all crammed in together. And I was feeling this, I was feeling really cooped up because I'm used to this level of just like, I'm going to stay up till 6 a.m. and like do whatever the fuck I want and make music and be louder. You know, this kind of
right.
freedom
I totally
of
understand.
Schedule, which I'm sure, yeah, you totally get. I feel like most, like any type of like writer or painter or, you know, you kind of like work at odd hours and.
Yeah, I'm definitely like that.
Yeah, and you're used to having some of that flexibility. And because I was with my family and we were like, you know, going to the ocean and like doing these really nice things, which, and I love my family very much. But I felt like a little rat in a cage and I was very kind of frustrated in this strange way. And so I wrote that bass line. I brought my bass home with me because I wanted to practice.
Okay,
I was like practicing it every day. I'm trying to get better, whatever. And I wrote that bass line that is kind of runs throughout the song. And I was thinking not just about Donald Trump, but I've been mulling it over since, but you know, I had this feeling, you know, when I think about, did you ever listen to the Marc Maron interview with Barack Obama?
No, I didn't actually. I love Marc Maron, but no, I didn't really listen to it.
Oh my God, you totally have to.
I will. I definitely will.
I listen to Marc Maron too. I listen to a lot of podcasts. And but it's, you know, I think what it brought home for me was just, you know, what, regardless of your politics, like Barack Obama is a very articulate, thoughtful, open, tolerant person.
Yes, I agree with that.
You know, listening to, I know people use this adjective like professorial as negative about him, but you listen to him talk and there's like an eloquence and a beauty to it. And I was just thinking, you know, and I had said this to a friend that like, I think if Kim Kardashian ran for president, she'd win too. Like, I don't even think it has to do with necessarily like politics or dissatisfaction. I think it's that like, we're in this place where like it just feels like nothing is sacred, like the presidency, fuck it, like let's have a reality star be the guy, like
right.
who knows nothing, who's like, I mean, you know, he's truly this erratic, very very strange thinking. I mean, this is somebody who's disagreeing with like all the scientists in the world. It's completely insane. And then I'm just like, and you know what? Like, there's naked pictures of everybody on the internet. There, this age of utter transparency, it just made me feel like we have devolved rapidly.
Yes.
And I just felt like, you know, we're destroying the earth, you know? Like, we're just, I don't know what's happening, but it is happening, and it's, like, upsetting to me.
Do people just not, like, care? Like, are their lives so boring they just want to, like, what's the craziest thing that can happen? Like, is
oh
that
God.
How people are voting? Like, I don't understand,
I think,
you know? Or people just really believe this, or they're I just don't, you know, you say the thing about Obama being, you know, a beautiful speaker and having this eloquence, and don't you think most people should be more attracted to that than people spouting like aggression and hate? You know, well, just based on surface alone, you know, it just blows my mind. But it's not. But I guess the world doesn't work like that.
It's so weird.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know how the world works, clearly. But this was all, I guess this is to say, this was all kind of brewing in my mind. And my family's very, very like left politically, and also my sister works for the government. Like we're a pretty, you know, politically minded family. So it was, politics were on the brain, but I just wrote that bass line and came up with that first line, which is now the title of the song, which I repeat throughout it.
Yeah.
Just, and then I kind of felt like, you know, I know a lot of the people that, especially a lot of the newer listeners to my music are young people who didn't vote in this election. And I do think it's important if you feel like you want to have a voice in this way, I think it's important to do it. So I was sort of like, fuck it, let's like finish this song. Let me make it into a song. And And then I turned it in right before the record was due, like a day before.
Oh, cool. That's cool. You know, it's always funny when songs can kind of come out of like the like last minute, the one you don't expect to make the album. And you're like, oh, yeah, it's there. It's awesome. I like always totally. Like that. I always like that. So you mentioned a little bit earlier about how you got signed very early in your career to RCA. And mm-hmm. then you ended up leaving RCA Records. And I read somewhere that you basically lost like 60 songs to the label because you're under contract yeah. with them when you wrote all these songs. How did that happen? You must have some regrets there about how that all shook out. Maybe not the leaving part, but having to lose all that material and actually, if you could start with how you got signed, because people love hearing that story too, how you got discovered by RCA and all that.
Oh, well, actually, the discovery story maybe isn't that interesting. I was doing a lot of sample-based music when I started out, largely just because I didn't have the capacity to, like, record a lot of instrumentation. So I would just use, you know, like a bass sound from something else or a little riff or whatever.
Right.
And I put out a song that sampled a Grizzly Bear song, and it kind of just did really well on the internet. And this was at a moment when Hype Machine was, I kind of feel like, nearing the apex of its like A&R viability or something like that. And maybe it still is. It seems like it's more remix based now, but
yeah.
So anything that hit number one was like immediately every like A&R person at yeah, any label
around.
Was calling.
Sure.
Yeah. So that was essentially what happened. And I had just started working with Seth, my manager, and we were like fielding all these calls, and it was very overwhelming. And I ended up, it's actually quite a long story, and maybe you'll just have to have me back to fully explain
sure,
it.
Sure, I'd love to have you back. Absolutely.
The president of Epic Records at was a woman named Amanda Ghost, and she kind of became this big champion for me. And I didn't sign with her, but I signed a publishing deal first, and kind of waited on a record deal, and then moved to New York and started working on more material, and then signed to RCA. So I had kind of been talking to them and some other labels for like about a year, and then
right.
finally made that decision. So it felt like, you know, in my mind, I was thinking it through, which was good, but I just still did not have that internal knowledge quite yet of who I was, even just as a person on some level, and as like a young adult. And, you know, when you say like, I lost these songs, it's true. I did, but I actually, they weren't that good. Like, I had reached this point, you know, I got signed because I was weird. And as soon as I got signed, they wanted to make me less weird. And,
yeah.
and you know, I got put in the first session I ever did was with Pharrell. You know what I mean? Like, I came from
damn, that going, must have been kind of, what's the word? Like, scary? I don't know.
Yeah, it was scary. I actually... Here, okay, this is kind of a funny story. I'll
yeah,
tell
yeah.
So
I want to hear that story.
I got flown out to Miami to work with him. And by the way, I will say he was incredibly nice and generous and warm, like everything you would want him to be. He was. And so on a personal level, I really enjoyed the experience. But that day was when I signed the contract to RCA. So they like couriered the contract to the studio, and I signed it there. And I think other people were wanting it to be this like moment, you know,
yeah.
where it's,
yeah.
so we went out to this really nice dinner. That was like, I ended up spending $200 on dinner. And like, I'm, you know, as I mentioned to you, I'm from the Midwest. Like this morning, what I had for lunch today was a piece of toast with butter and a hard boiled egg. Like, I'm a simple woman. And so we went out to this like really elaborate dinner, and I got back to the hotel, which was also this nice hotel, and just threw up. And it kind of, I should have seen it as a metaphor because it ended up kind of happening that way. But or as a harbinger, I guess, for the years to come.
Right. But, yeah. Damn.
Yeah. So, right. The night I signed my record deal, I vomited a $200 dinner, the most expensive dinner I had ever bought in my life. And yeah, so I just got thrown into a lot of sessions, yeah. You know, and this is like, I know it's a super common thing among, especially solo artists. Bands too now, but definitely solo artists, like, you know, with different producers, and it's hard to not lose yourself in that process. I agree,
especially as a new artist, because, you know, you don't really know what you're standing up for, you know.
Yeah,
you have an idea, they have an idea, and it's like, well, who's, like, which direction do we go? And it's like sometimes hard to fight for your own when you don't even really know what you're what you're trying to do.
Yeah, and if somebody's, you know, 20 years older than you or 15 years older and has had, like, massive success, you know, you kind of, logic tells you you should probably defer to them a little bit. But you know what was, I actually, somebody made this premonition early in my career, right when I signed. They were like, you know what, you're probably going to, like, spend 3 years in sessions learning things and then get dropped and then be more successful when you leave, which is, like, you know, I guess what happened ultimately,
right.
But,
yeah.
I did learn a lot from those sessions, but, you know, when I look back on a lot of those songs, there's great stuff in some of them, but I was in a very lost place, and I think I had like a 2 month mourning period and then I just moved on.
Yeah. Well, was with the labels too, like, being, you know, on a major label and stuff, were they telling you, like, what, well, obviously they're telling you what to do, like, who to work with and stuff, but were they telling you, like, what to wear, what to say, how to look, like, that whole side of it, was that a part too? Because that seems like, as a woman too, that would be something they would be concerned about, maybe more so than, oh, he's like a rock guy wearing a leather jacket, whatever, you know what I mean?
Right. You know, oddly enough, they were not. And I really appreciated that. I do feel like the people that I worked with at RCA, and I actually have run, you know, I've obviously seen many of them since these days, I still really have a lot of respect and affinity for. I mean, I think nobody ever sought to compromise, like, my basic integrity in any way. It was more just like, hey, like, work with this producer and we'll find the sound here. It was more... I think about the musical content, but the other thing too is, and I know you're not, like, we're not interacting in a physical space at the moment, but I feel like once you meet me, you kind of know that I wouldn't do that.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I think there was a sense right off the bat that was not going to be a part of the program.
The negotiation, yes.
Yes.
The non-negotiable. Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely.
What you see is what you get. And that's, I think ultimately though, people like that about you, because they're like, you really are genuine. Like, you're not fake. And a lot of, you know, artists, mainstream major label artists, whatever you want to call it, are really just really fake. Like, there's not any substance and nothing's real. And that's the truth, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's like, I think I one of the lessons I learned really early on with touring, especially when I was, because I used to play alone on stage. So it's, you know, which is kind of a scary thing, potentially.
Yeah, absolutely it is.
And I think what I intuited and then later was able to sort of formulate coherently in my mind was this understanding that if I were truly expressing myself on stage, if I was in the moment and I believed in the songs, even if the songs were super shitty, like, I look back and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. Like, I'm just like, I cringe at myself. But, I mean, I know we all cringe, but I think what caused me to, you know, to continue on and for people to like not boo me off stage or, you know, not to have like these super negative reactions and sometimes positive reactions, it was that I was just really being true to myself. You know,
yeah.
I was,
yeah.
And I think, you know, that's really guided me far. And it's something that I'm certainly drawn to in other, like, just people in general, not even music people. And I also find it very embarrassing to not be myself. Like, I feel this weird humiliation when I try to, like, pretend.
Yeah, I totally understand that.
So, which I think is, for some people, I think it's the reverse. They feel very, like, humiliated and embarrassed to be themselves.
That must be a horrible way to live.
Yeah.
You know?
That seems, yeah, that just made me kind of sad saying
yeah,
that out loud.
Yeah, for sure. Me too. That's crazy. But what happened with RCA? Like, why the breakaway and then becoming an indie artist for a minute and then obviously being on Interscope now and having a brand new record out? How did that all kind of shake out?
Well, the shakeout, it was like a gradual. I was kind of putting out these mixtapes and stuff, and they were being cool with it, like being like, hey, do whatever you want. We're not going to help promote them or anything, but like. You can put them out,
okay.
which is
all right. Which is okay. Yeah,
yeah. Totally. So I was kind of like flying under the radar. I put out at the very end, I put out this EP that just like, I mean, there's some good things about it. And there were a couple songs that I really loved, but it just felt like, I don't know. I think it felt certainly to me like there was nothing productive happening in our partnership. And mm-hmm. Again, as a testament to the people that I worked with over there, they acknowledged that. And, you know, we asked if we could be dropped and they did that.
That's pretty cool. So you know, you hear about like bands getting like fucking tied up in shit for years, you know, and mm-hmm. they can't make new records and they can't because they're under contract and all this stuff, you know. So, you got to give them some respect for that, for sure.
Oh, for yeah. sure. I mean, I've said this a couple times before, but I really do think about that record deal as like a first very young marriage.
Yeah.
Like
right.
You don't really know each other. You don't know yourself. Like you don't know what you want in a partner, you know, in a way. And so but luckily like there were no kids, you know,
I didn't put out
a record.
You're really good at this stuff, this analogy stuff. That's like the third or fourth one you've just like nailed it. This is awesome.
Okay.
Okay. Cool.
Hopefully more on the way. But yeah, so that they let me go and then I was like bummed out for a second. And then I wrote this album, which is my first album, Life is a Dog, which I then, you know, I had been touring pretty relentlessly. Mm-hmm. So I had this really invested, not huge, but a fan base that I really like cultivated and interacted with. And I think we felt connected to each other. And so put out that record and we did a crowdfunding for it, which I was pretty anxious to do. Anxious in the sense that I was nervous, sorry,
yeah.
not eager.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
And
I know that can feel, I mean, that's the whole crowdfunding yeah. thing is still like a little bit like, I'd say the last few podcasts I've done, we've talked about it because a few bands, like it's becoming so prevalent. Mm-hmm. And I always ask people, like, did you have kind of mixed feelings about like doing that and putting that pressure on your fans? And then there's also the like, well, what if it doesn't get there? You know, there's like there's like two fears, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, how was that for you?
I mean, you know, it was good. It was very unexpectedly so positive, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I put out a lot of music for free. Like, up until that point, almost everything I had put out was free.
Right.
So, I do think there was this, a lot of people felt like they wanted, they like, at shows all the time, people would be like, can I pay for this? And I was like, no, it's just free, download it. So I think there was a sense that people wanted to support and wanted to,
sure,
you know, actively wanted to do that. And I'm also by nature I feel guilty all the time. So as soon as I know that somebody's expecting something from me, like I will deliver it. So I, you know, the minute it was like, oh shit, now we've like, we funded this thing and we, you know, we went like over our goal and we had just this like really beautiful outpouring of support. I was like, okay, gotta do it. And, you know, I busted out that record in like a couple months, everything. And it was, I think it really renewed my faith in myself and in the business of this, because as you know from being on the road and touring and spending time with people, like, it's essentially a human transaction, yeah. You know, between a listener and somebody making something. And it's absolutely being reminded of that, you know, in the wake of this kind of like career disappointment or failure, or however you want to view it, was very affirming and kind of, I think, sort of kept me on the path.
Well, your relationship with your fans is pretty cool. And I know one thing I wanted to ask you about, which I thought was really rad and a really cool idea, was the Crush Me book.
Oh, yeah.
Which you had, I guess you had it just at your merch table, basically, and people would be able to write kind of their heartbreaking moments or mm-hmm. moments where they've caused heartbreak, which I thought was sort of also a cool thing for people to kind of get a release from that. Tell me how that came about and you know, how that was for you, like, obviously reading those stories.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I've had this sense, and this is actually sort of where the title for this last album came from,
yeah,
but
right.
this sense of, like, right, you go to a place and on some level it's just like every other place.
Right.
You know,
the title is Everywhere is Somewhere, right? Just so people
know. The title is Everywhere is Somewhere.
Yes.
And, you know, so it's kind of a play on that word some, which is like everywhere is just somewhere. You know, the sky exists. People are trying to, like, live and love and get fucked up on the weekends and follow a sports team. And, you know, it's like even in the face of, you know, incredible tragedy and hardship, people are just looking for the same stuff. And, you know, then the flip side is that everywhere is somewhere. Like, it's a place that's yeah. imbued with incredible meaning and memory and, you know, pain or joy or whatever it is. And I think touring really drives that home. And so I sort of wanted to capture that spectrum of universality, but also specificity. In terms of every night in, in every city, giving people a chance to express their place at that moment. And mm-hmm. I'm a really big believer in physical things, especially in our digital age. Like, at this point, like, posting something to Instagram isn't that interesting. You know, it's like everybody does that.
True.
I think it's more compelling to engage people in a physical sense, you know. And this book kind of affirmed that for me, because people were I posted about it, you know, like, once to explain it, and then people just, they just went with it. I mean, yeah. like, it was its own, it's kind of its own thing. And I don't know. I mean, it was really, like, I would read it, and some of the stuff in there was just so heartbreaking and really, you know, it's a reminder too, like, even when you're at the grocery store, like, the person next to you may have just, like, might be going through the craziest.
Right. Of course. You don't know. You don't know. Absolutely.
Yeah. Loss, or, you know, 'cause it'd be things like, you know, my brother killed himself and I don't know what to do. Or I think I just met the person that I'm, like, going to have kids with, you know, so it's just, and then everything in between.
Did that start making you view your fans differently? Like, all of a sudden when you started reading this stuff, were you, like, looking out in the crowd and just being, like, almost, like, putting these stories into these random people and being, like, that person could be this? Like, did you find, like, more of an emotional connection with your fans? Because I feel like that could happen.
Yeah, I think more than that, I just felt this greater sense of responsibility and obligation a little bit for the show to be an incredibly safe space for people to be vulnerable and open and yes. connected to themselves and to other people. And I think, you know, as the person on stage with the microphone, you set the tone. And if I'm up there really connecting with the experience, being emotional, I think that, you know, I think the book just made me remember, like, every night before I get up on stage, like, I need to put myself in that headspace. Like, I don't want to ever be phoning it in, because you know, people are using this time, this 1 hour, to or an hour and a half or whatever it is to get, you know, to connect to themselves in a different way or to leave themselves for a little bit or, you know, whatever it is.
No, it's a really beautiful thing. And it's like, I think it's an amazing idea, which I would totally rip off if I didn't like you. no, but it's really, really awesome. So I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I want to ask you a little bit just about like your transition from kind of doing more of a rap thing into singing. And, you know, because obviously singing isn't usually something people just pick up overnight, but you become quite a great singer.
Well, thank you. I mean, I feel like I'm... okay, so two parts to this answer, organizing my thoughts. the first is that singing was new to me and therefore exciting, you know, as this thing, like, once I kind of figured out how to use my voice, it was really, from a creative standpoint, I was like, oh my God, look at all these things I can do now.
Right.
You know, with melody, and it just opened up, I think, a new world of songwriting. Plus, as you can tell from this interview, like, I'm a fairly talkative person, and I think I need something to rein me in. And when I was rapping, you know, you can say like 8,000 words in a rap song. You can't say as many in a more traditional sung song.
Yeah, you're right. So yeah, you're totally right.
It's like a form of editing, like built-in editing, which I think forced me to really consider, like, okay, what are the essential elements of what I'm saying? How can I include detail, but only the important detail, you know, and not litter this thing, you know, as like a long novel, but thinking about it as a short story. And so that was, I think I understood at some point that was a good thing.
Did it change your performances? Like when you were like, oh, or even how you lived, like being like, oh, I got to sing, like I got to like hit these notes and stuff. Like if my voice is a little messed up, like did you start being a little more stressful for you or not really?
I feel like, my manager will be mad at me, but no, I didn't change anything. I mean, I warm up now. I've been warming up for the last like maybe 8 months. But before that, I truly did nothing. Like I'd have a shot of whiskey and go on stage. And
I'm more in that category myself. So I,
yeah. And it also depends, I think too, on the kind of singing you're doing. You know, for me, a lot of my singing is like kind of tone heavy. Like I have a very particular tone, whatever, when I sing, mm-hmm. and I'm not hitting, you know, the range of notes that I'm hitting is not immense.
Right, so, you're not belting out the highest note you can sing at every time.
Absolutely not. Right. No. So it's not as taxing, you know, it's not like I'm Adele out here. doing, like, nowhere even close. I'm one-tenth of Adele. So singing was... I think it helped me to focus in a lot of ways. And then, you know, on the flip side of that, I would sing and people would say to me like, hey, I really like the way your voice sounds. And this was, you know, before people had said, oh, hey, I really like what you're saying.
Right.
And now they were kind of giving me this other feedback. They were like, I like what you're saying and I like the tone of your voice.
Was there any self-consciousness about it when you started doing it?
Oh, for sure. I felt very uncertain about it, you know, and I think I was lucky, you know, again, to have that, the strange resilience or whatever within myself to just be like, okay, whatever, like this is this new thing. And there was definitely a level of self-consciousness, though, you know, kind of buried underneath. And I think you chip away at that just through experience. That
yeah,
was, at least,
you're right.
Was
Absolutely.
How it went for me.
Totally, no, totally right. That's amazing. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to do this and everything.
For sure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, what's going on next for you? You got a new record that just came out, like, last week.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. I guess you're going to be doing some shows and stuff. How can people find you?
Yeah, I'm leaving next week. We play a show in two more shows in the U.S. We're going to Hawaii, where I've never been.
Ooh,
playing a show there.
That's fun.
Yeah, and then we're going to be in Australia for about a month, And
amazing.
Then, yeah, just essentially on tour for the foreseeable future.
Forever.
Forever. You know how it goes. But it's like that beautiful balance of recording stuff and then figuring out how it's going to live in a spontaneous, strange, dirty environment, and then doing it all over again.
That's how we roll. Well, thank you so much for taking the time, and I hope you have a great rest of your day, and maybe take it a little more easy on the coffee.
Yes.
Actually,
you
know
what?
No. I won't tell you what to do. You do.
No. Don't keep drinking coffee, and I hope if I don't speak to you or see you before a work tour, I hope it's a good summer and that you stay cool and don't drink too much beer behind the trailer.
Operation Don't Die
begins now.
Okay. Take care.
Take care, Shane.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
So there it is with Kay Flay. It's funny. We were talking in the interview about her having a lot of coffee. I've had a lot of coffee for this intro and now this outro. I just kind of realized my intro is a little crazy boy. That's okay, though. It's okay to be a little wild. I do love coffee. Just seriously, just hook it to my vein. It's perfect. But what a great talk. She is awesome. She has a new record out right now. It just came out. I've been blasting it all week. And she's going to Hawaii. She's going to Australia. She's doing all this crazy stuff. So make sure you check out her tour dates and go see her when she comes through your city. Next week, we will be back with a new episode, of course. And I hope my northern friends are starting to enjoy the patios, enjoying getting out, taking a walk, enjoying the fresh air. I love spring. It's here. I'm excited. Anyways, seriously, I just want to say thanks again for listening to this thing, helping spread the word. I know you guys tell your friends and tell your brothers and sisters and your moms and dads. My mom, big, big, big fan of the show. Hi, Mom. I know you're listening. Hi, Mom. So maybe your mom's a fan. Tell your mom. Go tell your mom about Lead Singer Syndrome. Anyways, yes. Okay, I'm going to have some water now. I got to mellow myself out. Maybe it's beer o'clock. Who knows? I pretty much just drink coffee and then it's time to drink beer. And that's just the way my days go. But seriously, thank you so, so much for all the support. As always, I will leave you with a tune. This is a killer song. I know you're going to love it. So here is Blood in the Cut by Kay Flay on Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love. We'll see you next week.
The boy I love's got another girl. He might be fucking her right now. I don't have an apartment. Thought if I was smart, I'd make it far, but I'm still at the start. Guess I'm contagious. It'd be safest if you ran. Fuck, that's what they all just end up doing in the end. Take my car and paint it black. Take my arm, break it in half. Say something, do it soon. It's too quiet in this room. I need noise. I need the buzz of a sub. Need the crack of a whip. Need some blood in the cup. I need noise. I need the buzz of a sub. Need the crack of a whip. Need some blood in the cup. I need Francisco. I don't have an agenda. All I do is pretend to be okay, so my friends can't see my heart in the blender. And lately, I've been killing all my time, reading through your messages, my favorite way to die. Take my head and kick it in, break some bread for all my sins. Say a word, do it soon. It's too quiet in this room. I need noise. I need the buzz of a sub. Need the crack of a whip. Need some blood in the cup. I need
Hello?
That was crazy.
I have no idea what happened.
I don't either, actually, to be honest with you. But anyway, yeah, whatever.
I don't know if we've totally lost our train of thought or we can go to something else.
No, actually, or if you remember my train of thought.
Yeah, go ahead then, and then I can just edit it in.
Okay. Well, maybe we can reveal afterwards, like, hey, we made that using the magic of computers.
Maybe we should.
Maybe we should. I think we should reveal it at the end.
Okay.